Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. A little something different on the pod today. This National Electricity Month, Electricity Canada is introducing you to the people who are the faces of the industry. Electricity Canada's Faces of the Industry Award highlights the work of six industry professionals who have demonstrated leadership in every aspect of the electricity sector. We created the Faces of the Industry Awards last year, and it came out of a simple but powerful premise. The electricity sector aren't just companies, they're people. The great thing about Faces is it's a real grassroots campaign. We had 47 nominations for the award, representing people from all parts of the electricity sector from every region. All we ask is for the recipient to demonstrate innovation, leadership, and outstanding achievement in the field. This year's award winners have been selected from every region of Canada and come from every part of the industry, including executive leadership, finance, engineering, line work, and procurement. What they have in common is leadership and innovation, and of course, their work in the electricity sector. I had the privilege of talking to all of this year's Faces of the Industry recipients for the Flux Capacitor, and it was humbling to realize the breadth of experience and talent the electricity sector possesses. I hope that you will experience this yourself as you listen to my conversations with this year's Faces of the Industry. On the pod today are three of those Faces of the Industry. First up on the podcast is
Sandra Haskins, Senior Vice President of Finance and CFO at Capital Power.
Welcome to the podcast and congratulations on being one of the 2025 Faces of the Industry, Sandra.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It's certainly an honor.
So I thought for the listener, it might be interesting to start off with a little bit about Capital Power and, why the CFO would be somebody who would be honored by their peers in the industry. So before we talk about, the $3 billion questions, maybe start off with just a little bit of a thumbnail sketch for folks about what Capital Power is all about from your perspective as CFO.
Yeah, certainly. So Capital Power has been around for 15 years when we IPO'd from EPCOR, which was the utility. We were an Alberta-based company that was in a deregulated market, and one of our key financial pillars was to remain investment grade. Mm-hmm. So we're currently BBB- with S&P and DBRS. So for us, that meant Capital Power needed to diversify outside of a single market. It mm-hmm. needed to have more contracted cash flows, and we needed to be a growth-oriented company. Mm-hmm. So in 2014, we decided to reset our strategy to continue down two parallel paths. And one was to build out renewables, which mm-hmm. were very much in favor at the time. So that was the beginning of energy transition. Mm-hmm. And the other was to acquire midlife natural gas. So it allowed us to get two different streams of generation that were contracted that would increase the stability of our cash flows. But from Capital Power's background as a generator and an operator and having the market expertise that we had, there was a real need from our perspective to have reliable, dispatchable energy to support the grid. Mm-hmm. And so we saw that there was a number of assets in certain markets that were going to be needed for longer and felt that we could acquire them, build and make them more efficient to support those markets. Mm-hmm. So that's been sort of our mandate and our strategy as we go forward. So as I said, that was a time of energy transition. What we're seeing now is demand curves are certainly much more robust than right. they were back then. We sort of thought energy efficiency would flatten the curve, mm-hmm. and that is not the case. We're now seeing demand grow very, very rapidly. Mm-hmm. And so for Capital Power, that has provided the opportunity for us to continue to grow and expand. So over the last number of years, we've built a number of wind farms, we've done solar, we've added battery storage, mm-hmm. or in the process of adding battery storage at a couple of our Ontario sites, mm-hmm. Expand and upgrade generation to meet the growing demands and ensure that there's reliability and affordability in the market. So a CFO, what that meant is there's a fair bit of capital that needed to be raised in order to do that.
Right.
So I've been very active in the equity markets and the debt markets to finance this, as we've had a pretty stable cadence of growth in acquisitions and development. For a number of years, we were sanctioning about 2 renewable projects a year, as well as acquiring midlife natural gas. Mm-hmm. But probably our biggest undertaking was in Alberta, where our Genesee generating facility was mandated to be off coal by 2030 by the Alberta government in 2015.
Right.
So most of the baseload in the province was on coal. So mm-hmm. we undertook the analysis to see whether we would do a conversion to natural gas, which mm-hmm. is basically not a capital intensive solution, but it also does not decarbonize the unit. So you still are fairly inefficient. It would have cost us about $75 million mm-hmm. to convert all 3 units. We decided just to convert one. The other we decided to repower. And so that involved...
So just for the listener, the difference between converting and repowering was...
So I think if you looked at converting, it would be almost like taking your barbecue at home, changing it from being propane to natural gas. So
gotcha.
pretty easy switch out of some equipment to change the fuel type and deal with a different heat intensity.
But it's still the same barbecue, it's still the same burner.
Exactly. Yeah, right. So repowering is new in new equipment, mm-hmm. if you will. So it does have a new, highly efficient unit. So it's also a brownfield project. So you do use a lot of the existing mm-hmm. infrastructure, mm-hmm. Which brings the cost down materially. But we're still looking at $1.5 billion was the all-in project cost.
Sure. Yep.
To take 840 megawatts and convert it to 1,250 megawatts.
Mm-hmm.
So not only did we achieve being off coal 5 years in advance, we also reduced 3.4 megatons annually of CO2 emissions mm-hmm. from the project.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a 40% reduction in emissions, but a 60% increase in overall generation.
Right.
So you increased the capacity, lowered the emissions,
yep.
and provided long-term reliable energy for Albertans.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the question for a CFO is, where did you find $1.5 billion?
Well, we generate a fair bit of cash flow.
Yep.
So our cash flow goes towards paying dividends. So
mm-hmm.
roughly about 30% currently is our payout ratio. The rest we use to fund our growth.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously that still brings us a little bit short, but we've been successful in issuing equity as well as the debt capital markets. So
mm-hmm.
as I mentioned earlier, we've always looked to maintain our investment grade credit rating,
mm-hmm.
which means that you do have to raise equity in order to maintain your credit metrics.
Right.
So, you know, we spend a fair bit of time over our entire history of reaching out to investors. So our investor relations efforts are constantly ongoing and getting our name out, explaining who we are, this company out of Alberta that has this strategy, and letting them know our story, our strategy, and our how we implement, so that when we do go to market, we are successful and able to raise the funds that we need.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that our strategy really resonates with investors. Energy is essential to the communities we live and work in,
mm-hmm.
and you know, our long-term goals. And I think what's been important is everything we said we were going to do, we've done.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been very clear on our pathway and our direction, and we've delivered on that. So when we needed the money, it was there. And, you know, as far as Genesee, it's probably the largest decarbonization story around mm-hmm. that didn't use out-of-market incentives to do it. So we just completed our first full quarter of operations of the repowered units, and
mm-hmm.
our intensity of our emissions was below the benchmark at which you have to pay carbon tax. So
mm-hmm.
that tells you the efficiency of those units, and of course it is very reliable. Alberta being quite unique in that we're not blessed with some of the other resources that you see in other markets. We don't have large hydro.
Right.
As far as wind and solar, when you're looking at February, when temperatures can be sustained very, very cold, low,
mm-hmm.
all of the wind on the grid drops to zero.
Mm-hmm.
So we have zero generation from renewables. We're getting 8 or 9 hours of sunlight, so there's not a lot from solar. Mm. We need to have reliable, dispatchable generation. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. something that we get from our repowered units, so it's reliable and it's there when our consumers need it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't sort of stop there, as I said, with I think the whole... All of us would have thought a number of years ago that we wouldn't need the demand for power that we're seeing now. Certainly, yeah. as things are becoming electrified, you mm-hmm. have AI and data centers, mm-hmm. As you well know, that are driving demand. But the next sort of step is decarbonization, and where will the grid go a number of years out? So mm-hmm. from our perspective, we spent a lot of time looking at carbon capture and storage, feel yeah. that it is there from a technology perspective, but not yet economic. Likewise, SMRs is another opportunity that we're partnering with OPG on to explore bringing SMRs utility scale to Alberta. So, you know, if you want to have SMRs in the province in 2035, 2040, that work has to start today. It's
and
a very...
And you've begun that work.
We yeah. started that yeah. a year ago. So yeah. we're looking at that. And I think that, mm-hmm. you know, we sort of see that every market will have multiple answers to generation. It's not one technology that will carry the day, but there's a lot happening in terms of innovation and exploration of projects. And mm-hmm. so we continue to monitor those and feel that we'll be able to make that pivot when the time comes mm-hmm. to what that next generation of supply will come from.
So when you entered into the agreement with OPG to look at SMRs, was that the last technology that Capital Power had not yet been involved in? Because the company now covers pretty much every type of generation, right?
Pretty much. We don't do offshore wind, and we don't do hydro. So in our history, we have had a few run of river,
yep.
but
yep.
like nuclear, it is sort of unique in mm. terms of the expertise that you need, mm-hmm. and it was not something that we felt was necessarily a niche we would pursue. But mm-hmm. We are quite diversified by fuel type. And as I said, every market is unique in terms of the market construct, as well as what resources they happen to be blessed with or not. So
yeah.
For us, that has meant venturing into a number of different technology types.
Well, and diversity also with respect to the markets that you're in, right?
How many
markets, how many different jurisdictions is Alberta? Capital Power in these days?
Yes. So we're that's a good question. We're in Ontario,
yeah.
BC, and Alberta in
yeah.
Canada,
yeah.
and we're in 11 different states in the U.S.
Right.
So actually, that would be more now. We just did an acquisition last week, so I think mm. we're now in 13 different states.
Mm.
So different markets. So PGM being the market we just entered, we're in the desert southwest. We also mm-hmm. have the southeast and mm-hmm. as well as Pacific Northwest, which mm-hmm. is also part of the WEC market. So
right.
yeah.
Right. yeah.
So a number of different markets, but we see that there are very strong fundamentals in a lot of the different markets. So we look to be diversified across those markets and
mm-hmm.
and the flight to quality in terms of what assets you acquire. So
mm.
once again, our team is able to do their due diligence. In a lot of cases, when you're buying a plant, there's opportunity to improve its efficiency
mm-hmm.
And do uprates and expansions. And we have the operational expertise to do that, which differentiates us from many who
mm-hmm.
who go in and buy assets and are more of a financial player as opposed to a strategic that can bring that incremental value and add upside to our shareholders.
Right. Sandra, one of the things I ask folks that come on the podcast is about their journey. And I always make the same joke. When you were a little kid on the playground, did you always dream of being the CFO of a major energy company? What was your journey from that playground to Capital Power?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think I really just fell into it, to be honest. I knew I wanted to go to university, had no idea what I wanted to do. So I think that the subjects that I enjoyed most and that I excelled in most were math and science.
Mm.
I did 1 year of natural sciences and couldn't think of how I would marry that with a career. So where would be the end goal? And I think, you know, at that point in my life, I wanted to see a pathway. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see where it would end, and ended up going into business. Mm-hmm. And enjoyed that. I think my my final decision to go into accounting was, as I said, accidental. It mm-hmm. was I did major in finance and accounting, and got my first job, having just done 1 year in sciences. It meant that I was done after 3 years, with the exception of one course. Mm. And so I ended up getting a job in an accounting department in my final year of university, and they offered me a job at the end of it, and I've never looked back. So mm-hmm. that's kind of how it all fell together. So not overly well planned. Mm-hmm. It just sort of took advantage of any opportunity as it presented myself, right. and presented itself to me. And mm-hmm. this is where it's taken me.
Has it been energy throughout? Or?
No, I was in insurance for a number of years. So yeah, I worked in the life insurance industry in a number of different areas. I did spend part of my career in claims administration on the benefits side. So mm-hmm. a bit of a different pathway there for a number of years to try a little more on the management and administration side, but mm-hmm. then gravitated back into the financial stream.
All right. And I can't, you know, end the podcast without asking about that equity offering, which I'm told was the most in-demand institutional raise since Capital Power's IPO. Why? Is it because of the investment grade? What is it that has made that so successful?
Yeah, so we've actually done two that in the last little while. So mm-hmm. we did do an equity raise in December mm-hmm. In anticipation of doing an acquisition. So we wanted to tap the market before we went into earnings blackout, knowing mm-hmm. that there were a number of opportunities that we were looking at, and it was highly oversubscribed. And at that point in time, we didn't even have an acquisition to raise against. But I think we've just done a lot of legwork over the last number of years, getting out in front of investors, talking about the story. When you look at the IPPs in the U.S., their valuations have really taken off over the last number of years. Mm-hmm. We see the whole thematic around growing demand being sort of the tailwind. And so when we talk to investors, we talk about how we've been doing exactly what others are pivoting to do now. So when I described our strategy and how we've been executing, that's not a change for us. That's the way that we've been growing since 2014. And so I think the story really resonated, and people see the strong thematic in the energy business and saw us as a credible organization that has laid out what we were going to do, and we do what we say we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, it's paid off with us being able to twice now in the course of just over 3 months approach the equity market and get well oversubscribed demand for our shares. So we think we've done our best at putting that capital to work and generating a long-term history of a strong total shareholder return, and we're pleased to have those outcomes, especially last week when we approached the market. We were probably the first offering since the tariff announcements that have created some challenges in the market. So we were particularly pleased to be able to see that we still had investor support and confidence in our strategy.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. Yeah. Once again, Sandra, congratulations for being selected as one of the 2025 faces of the industry. Congratulations for being recognized by your colleagues and your peers for your leadership.
Well, thank you. It's truly an honor. So great. Really
Terrific.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for taking the time to join the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
My next guest on the podcast is
Joy Brake, Senior Technical Advisor with Nova Scotia Power.
Joy, welcome to the podcast, and congratulations on being one of the 2025 faces of the industry.
Oh, thank you very much, Francis. I'm very happy to be here.
So recognized by your your colleagues and your peers in the sector for leadership. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, what was happening in that space. And so my understanding is a lot of work has been taking place with respect to developing and implementing that system integration. And it is all about wind, solar, battery energy storage. For the listener, maybe how about a description of what you know, what this initiative has been all about?
So in Nova Scotia, we have a lot of coal mines because we had coal mines. So now we have a lot of coal generators.
Yep.
Coal, of course, we now wish to retire to meet decarbonization targets. So to take the coal off our system, mm-hmm. We need to replace it with something to serve the load. In Nova Scotia, what we have is great wind.
Yeah.
That's where all the hurricanes come in. We have lots of wind in Nova Scotia. So to take wind and replace a thermal, a synchronous plant, with a wind facility, which is asynchronous,
yep.
It doesn't have a built-in inertia.
Mm-hmm.
And then take a look at what support you're going to need to be make that wind equivalent in supplying energy to a thermal machine. That's the task at hand. And it is, it's very complicated. I remember when I was like a kid, I wanted to, you know, engineering rocket science. This is way harder than rocket science. there are a lot of grids on the planet where they've gone to very high IBR.
Yep.
But in Nova Scotia, we're also weakly connected to the rest of the interconnection. We're now in the process of getting a new tie line through mm-hmm. to New Brunswick, which will help that.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll still be relatively weakly connected, and our ability to pull in energy over those ties is limited. So to put these inverter-based resources mm-hmm. on, we got our first bit of experience with the Maritime Link. We put in an HVDC link between Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, and we had to work very closely with the equipment manufacturers and with Newfoundland mm-hmm. to think of how will it work. It's a very weak on the West Coast, Newfoundland. It was very weak in Cape Breton.
Mm-hmm.
So we got really a very good grounding in control systems in weak grids during that. We developed talent with Nova Scotia,
right.
And we also worked a lot of talent working with other planners in the Atlantic Canada. Like, we get together regularly in Atlantic Canada, mm-hmm. four provinces. We're developing common standards on how we're going to look at the models for wind and batteries and solar, and pulling on our experience gained with the Maritime Link to come up with solutions. So there's lots of areas.
While the Maritime Link didn't happen.
The Maritime, no, you're thinking Atlantic Loop. Atlantic Loop is in.
Yeah, sorry, pardon me.
Yeah, so that went in. Corrected. It was the first time yep. Newfoundland was connected to the
yes.
Eastern Interconnection.
Yep, Maritime.
That was so exciting.
Yeah.
I remember, like I say, when we had that first energy flow and the frequency in Newfoundland went to 60 hertz and stayed there instead of bouncing all around.
Yeah.
So what that link gave us initially, when it was just the one link connecting Newfoundland, if Newfoundland drop the generator suddenly, rather than having to drop customers, which you do when you're an island,
yeah.
it would rapidly, like in milliseconds, pull the energy from Nova Scotia,
mm-hmm.
and in that few seconds, their generators would ramp up and equalize the frequency, and then they would stop drawing on Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked spectacularly well.
Yeah.
We had forest fire and ice storm, both of which connected Cape Breton, two separate events,
mm-hmm.
from the rest of the mainland in Nova Scotia. Both times, we pulled on Newfoundland,
mm-hmm.
and we got enough support from them that it allowed us to survive the event better than we would have otherwise. It was two fairly significant events. One forest fire took out a major transmission corridor, four high-voltage lines. There was another time we had a massive ice storm took out, separated us from New Brunswick, separated Nova Scotia mainland from Cape Breton, and in both those times, we pulled on Newfoundland.
Mm.
So we could see how control systems could be tuned and develop to work spectacularly well.
Right.
So we went into this wind and battery with the mindset that we know how to do electromagnetic transient studies based on our experience there.
Mm-hmm.
We know that if we have a very good model of the system, it will match reality extremely well. Oh, Maritime Link. This was another fun one.
Mm.
We have 345 kV line going into the substation where the Maritime Link, the HVDC, connects.
Okay.
And it's like, hang on.
On the Nova Scotia side.
On the Nova Scotia side, 345 kV goes into the terminal for the HVDC. And it's like, okay, I want to be sure before the vendor's gone that this works like it's supposed to. I was in the process of arranging to have a contractor come, put a chain into the 345 kV line, create a fault, and make sure it matched our simulated response.
Mm-hmm.
I was so disappointed. Lightning struck that line within a few kilometers, so I got all the data I needed, but I didn't get the fun of
actually
running. Now, we did do it with the drone
you
testing.
Wanted, you wanted to get to sabotage.
I just wanted,
you wanted to
see
sabotage
it.
The
I
line
just
yourself.
To see it. We did that with the DC. We used drone. We took the drone up. We put the copper wire in. That's on YouTube somewhere.
Yeah.
And what we found is that our models, when we put in our simulated world at power system, when we put a lightning strike there, it looked exactly the same as when we experienced a lightning strike in reality.
Right.
We had the traces. We could see what happened. So we know that if we have very good modeling, we can very accurately represent what's going to happen in the real world. So take that forward a couple of years from the Maritime Link, and now we're looking, okay, the wind is coming. We got to figure this out.
Right.
Grid-forming batteries. Not grid-forming. It was batteries. For the energy arbitrage, to make the energy work where it's intermittent, we wanted to have batteries, transmission batteries. And it's like, okay, we need the technical specification. Over the last year or so, NERC is now recommending grid forming for transmission batteries in North America. In 2021, Nova Scotia Power said, thou shalt have grid forming on your batteries that are coming into Nova Scotia.
Okay.
We were pretty confident that we would use it sometime. So we have grid following, grid forming. Grid following means it takes signals from the grid and it gives you a megawatt output and it gives you a Q output. Grid forming means it's more like a traditional machine. It gives you an output of megawatts based on the system frequency and it gives you a Q output based on the voltage at that point. So we said, yeah, we think we're going to need this. It must be in the spec. And we had to defend that pretty strongly. Well, we're now doing those PSCAT, those EMT studies. It will be in grid forming all the time. If we had not specified grid forming 4 years ago, we would have probably needed synchronous condensers to make those batteries be fully stable with 100%
wind. Right, okay.
So, not sure where I might be taking this a little more deep than you wanted to go, just
That's
saying.
All right.
But to make this system work, they've done this in a lot of places around the world, but we're also hearing about black grids, cascading outages.
Yeah.
In Nova Scotia, we're building on our knowledge, and we've put a team together specifically for these EMT studies, and we are very confident in our results if you got good models. So we do a lot of work with the OEMs. We've gone back, and we're getting vendors to give us models for existing wind, and we test, and we test, and we test. And what we found is that we need to be more stringent in putting wind on than, say, the rest of North America. Like NERC right now, they're trying to put up PRC standards. And it's like, oh, type 3 wind only has this profile. So they're allowed to do this much. Type 4 must do this much. We're saying, no. Your plant must be able to support the voltage at your point of interconnection. And you must be able to stay online for all normal grid events, lightning strikes, loss of lines, all of that. Which means we have more stringent requirements to connect wind in Nova Scotia than just about anywhere. It requires like a synchronous style support or equivalent. And we found nothing yet as good as a synchronous condenser, although we're finding, you know, there's some of the grid-forming batteries are pretty good. We've got one right now for a customer. We're looking at a combination of a grid-forming battery with solar together. We're working through the models. Once we got good models, we will stand by the results that's coming in those simulations because we've matched those simulated world against real world events. So that has led to us to have more stringent criteria, but we also have a lot of confidence that it is going to work. The other thing in our why we're so stringent is we don't want to say you put, oh, it's really strong, you can connect a wind farm there. It's really strong, you can connect one there. We're saying anywhere in Nova Scotia, that is a transmission line that can get your megawatts out, you can put it there if you meet this standard.
If you meet the standard.
Yes, which includes that support. Your plant must be able to stay online during all grid events. It must deliver voltage support. And like I say, it can't get into oscillatory behavior. It can't be dragged off.
So what are you kind of creating synthetic inertia?
What's synthetic inertia?
Well, because you said, as you move away from the traditional types of generation that have large spinning systems and you're moving into something that is inverter-based, does it react?
When they talk about inertia, and this is something that's been happening over the last couple of years, a lot of times what they mean is frequency support, that megawatt support.
Yeah.
That's been solved. Okay. Batteries can, like the Maritime Link, like I say, in Newfoundland, with the Maritime Link, they lose a generator. Nova Scotia can send them energy automatically over the Maritime Link fast enough that they do not go in under frequency load check.
Yeah.
I would consider that a synthetic response.
Okay.
In Nova Scotia, we're looking to have batteries help support that.
Gotcha.
But inertia, everybody's got kind of focused on this megawatt. Inertia, what they're talking about is the big thermal plants have that heavy rotating mass.
Yep.
60 hertz, trucking along.
Yep.
Bump on the power system. That keeps moving. You got the head of steam. It keeps cranking out at 60 hertz for a while, and that helps stabilize the frequency. And people have focused on that megawatt. It also produces fault current and provides voltage response.
Mm-hmm.
So the second part of inertia, which hasn't really been looked at, is that fault current and the voltage response. So the grid-forming batteries that we have are able to stay online, and they are able to do the megawatt response. Okay. They do not produce fault current, but they can stay online and they can support the point of interconnection. So they are a go as long as the grid forming in their point of interconnection.
Yeah.
And we're going to get more stringent because grid forming is a name that means different things. There's different types of grid forming. It's not real grid forming. It's kind of a synthetic. But so we're going to get more stringent on what kind of grid forming we want in our battery. So that's one part. Back to the wind. There is nothing yet. I know there's some R&D going on grid forming wind. It's not there. I told them, come talk to me when you get there. I really would like to test it. It's not there yet. Yeah. We've got some of the vendors. They're able to demonstrate. They can ride through at lower short circuit MVA, but then we're still seeing a bit of oscillatory behavior for what I would consider normal fault. So it's like, no, synchronous support, the synchronous condenser or equivalent, and there's nothing yet. Now, we've got another one they're trying to do it with a battery. They may. We're always looking at ways to do this better and at a better, lower cost. Right now, it's synchronous condensers. We're in the process of acquiring those. I'm not sure when in the interview I was in earlier today. Is my goal right now, as soon as I got a delivery date for those synchronous condensers, I am getting in our work area, in our part of the building, there's going to be a year and a month of when we can run 100% IBR in Nova Scotia with confidence.
Wow.
That's my goal. I'm hoping it's within a couple of years. We've got a little bit of must-run hydro I probably wouldn't be allowed to turn off, but we, I believe, are going to be able to do it with the grid-forming batteries, the wind, and the synchronous condensers. I think we're there.
Wow.
Especially when we get the second tie line, because that'll give us that. That'll be a huge boost for reliability and the damping that we get there for frequency. We wouldn't have to worry about rock-off rate of change of frequency if we got that second tie. So that's a big bonus. So, yeah, second tie line, synchronous condensers, bring it on.
When's that second tie line?
Second tie line, still a couple of years out on that yet. Yeah. We're in approval processes and then there's the build. We're doing massive studies because somebody's, we got a proposal in right now. It's online. You can see in the queue to put a 340 megawatts of wind on that tie line, which that gets very interesting because it's so close to New Brunswick. The synchronous support that's going to be needed. It's in conjunction with a very interesting load type. There's just so much on the go. It's just fabulous.
Yeah. Joey, one of the things I ask folks that come on the podcast is about their journey. So interested to hear what your journey
How did
was.
I get to what I'm doing
yeah,
right now?
Yeah, when you were a kid on the playground, is this what you always dreamed of doing?
Well, when I was a kid on the playground, I didn't spend it probably at the playground. I spent it in the library.
Okay.
Reading books that specifically, there's a couple in specifically about engineering. There was one was an electrical engineer and one was, there was a couple and they were civil process, industrial engineers.
Huh.
So yes, but then, I mean, I remember getting electricity, okay? I'm from a very small community, Newfoundland. Life didn't take me right to engineering. I ended up raising my kids in my 20s. I did what worked part-time. I had a business on the side for a bit, things like that. Overseas for a bit, took me there into my 30s. So I get back to Halifax, moved to big city, Dalhousie University. Look at that. I need a good job. What's the fastest way to get a good job? Engineering.
Ah, okay.
What's the easiest engineering you can do? Electrical. Which is always everybody's reaction, but I'm math.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd like programming and math and that kind of, you know, probability and statistics. That's the kind of brain I have. That's my favorite stuff ever. So I'm 45 years old. Nova Scotia Power gave me a scholarship. Started there, never looked back.
Wow.
Yeah. So I've had a blast.
Mm. Joy, I want to thank you for taking the time to pop on the podcast, but also once again to congratulate you for being selected by your colleagues and your peers to be one of the 2025 faces of the industry. So thanks very much and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And our third guest today is...
Jeff Laniga from Manitoba Hydro. I'm the section head of transmission, live line, and electrical effects.
Jeff, congratulations on being one of the faces of the industry in 2025.
Well, thank you. It's a great honor to be here and receive that award and represent Manitoba Hydro.
Let's dig into one of the reasons why you're here. So live line engineer... So what does that entail just for the listeners? So they at least first off get an understanding of what it is that like you do.
Well, when they say live line engineer, I'm responsible for all of the safety criteria for the live line crews, supporting the development of new tools and new procedures, everything from, even the environmental conditions they work in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what is that when you're talking about new tools? I'm just looking at some of my stuff. Advanced insulating ropes? What is an advanced insulating rope?
So essentially, Manitoba Hydro experienced flashovers on insulating hot sticks.
Yep.
So they're long insulating tubes that you would do live working on energized lines.
Right.
So when I say live working, that's the maintenance of transmission lines without shutting off the power.
Right.
So at Manitoba Hydro, that means 500,000 volts,
right.
Either alternating current or DC. So,
you're working on the line while it's live, so the customer doesn't lose power. So
the customer doesn't lose power.
Yeah.
We also don't lose revenue.
Yeah.
We're keeping the reliability of the system intact.
Right.
Yeah.
So
the insulating ropes you asked about.
Yeah.
So essentially, because of those accidents we had, we found that those accidents occurred because of contamination on the tools that was so light you couldn't even see it. So
contamination on the tools.
Yeah.
So that means they weren't supposed to be conducting and they did conduct?
Yes, they did conduct. So what we found was it was from very, very light salt contamination, which could have been from the winter roads, salts getting onto the vehicles, onto their gloves, and then transferring onto the hot sticks.
Okay.
Or it could even be from, when workers work and the sweat comes through their gloves.
Yeah.
And that's sodium chloride.
Yeah.
And so when we have those accidents, ropes made out of synthetic materials, polypropylenes.
Okay.
Even in live working, people are doing, utilities are using ropes from the climbing industry for mountain climbing,
mm-hmm.
and they're accessing energized, and they're only relying on the dry properties of those ropes. So we were finding, we knew that we wanted to have ropes now that we could clean,
right.
And also we wanted ropes that would meet the standards. We were finding that a lot of the ropes wouldn't meet the existing standards that we were testing too.
Oh, wow. Okay.
When we tried to do our own testing.
Yeah.
So we went down a journey of trying to develop a rope that could be used for various applications. And I could explain to you all the ways we've innovated and implemented if you want.
But so you've basically developed ropes.
Ropes with a thermoplastic extruded jacket.
Okay.
There was the first that
didn't exist before. This is
The first generations of these ropes were created for Hydro-Québec.
Okay.
Hydro-Québec did a project where they strung new Skywire over energized 735 kV lines without outages.
Okay.
So this rope was created for that application. But right. The first generation of these ropes was extremely rigid and unusable for a live worker.
Okay.
They were very stiff.
Right.
In the cold, they would be hard to put through pulleys and blocks, etc.
Yeah.
So I went to this company out of Montreal called Barry Cordage. They're the one that developed that for Hydro-Québec. And I said, can you make ropes that are knotable and flexible that still have this coating? So together we innovated these ropes and went through testing. And now it's actually leading to enhancing the international standards. I get the opportunity to work through IEC and change the international standards to consider these higher properties of these ropes.
Right, right. And they're being they're being manufactured here as well?
They're manufactured in Montreal.
In Canada?
In Canada.
Wow, okay. Yeah. So that's another tick in its favor as well.
Yeah.
That's terrific. Yeah. And so used in live working, helicopter ops, rescue tasks. Maybe again for the listener. Maybe describe what does helicopter ops mean? I've got a pretty good idea, but I'm not sure the listener knows when we're talking about live line work and helicopter ops.
Yeah, so helicopters, we actually used a company out of Vancouver, or British Columbia, I should say. It's called Ascent Helicopters, and they developed their methods with BC Hydro over the last 20 years. And they're one of the most experienced in the world of working around utility environment, energized environment.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, BC Hydro, they used to use helicopters and have workers on working off the skid.
Off the
or a platform.
Right.
So that's the way they started.
Yeah.
But we've seen industry accidents on transmission lines where there's been contact with rotors and lines or helicopters getting tangled in the transmission structure.
Yeah.
So they developed in British Columbia, they developed what's called the hoisting method. And the hoisting method is basically allowing the worker to stay in the helicopter a longer portion of the time.
Right.
And when they're working, they're lowered down to the transmission structure while the helicopter stays at a higher elevation away from
a safer distance.
So you can do all... I wouldn't say a helicopter's any different than doing live working out of an aerial device.
Okay.
For example, it's the same principle. It's just an access tool.
Right.
Can you do things with a helicopter, obviously, that you couldn't with an aerial device? Yes, because you can get to places. Like in Manitoba Hydro, we've done projects in recent years where in 2 weeks we accomplished as much work as it would have normally taken 3 winters of building winter roads in the wintertime.
Just because you were accessing.
Just because we were able to access and have that speed.
Okay.
Speed of access. So from an electricity point of view, I would argue that a helicopter is the safest form of live working because you have no path to ground and you're like a bird sitting on a wire.
Path to ground, yeah.
So from an electrical point of view, I'd say it's very safe.
And then one of the things I ask folks who come on the podcast is about their journey. So when you were a kid on the playground, did you dream of that this is what you would be doing?
No.
So what was your journey from the playground as a kid to the work that you're doing today?
For myself, actually, when I graduated from high school, I wouldn't say my marks were like crazy out of the ballpark, but I did develop a love for math and sciences.
Okay.
I didn't even know what I wanted to be. I did a year of sciences at the University of Winnipeg.
Yeah.
And then I went on to engineering, and I decided to go into electrical engineering.
Okay.
And then by my fourth year, I start to form an interest in power systems, and I start to realize I'd like to stay in the province and work for Manitoba Hydro.
Mm-hmm.
So then that was in around 1999, and then I started as an engineer in training at Manitoba Hydro.
Mm-hmm.
I gained a lot of my initial experience in power system studies and doing, interconnection studies and power transient studies. And then I had a colleague in Liveline that wanted to bring that expertise to do studies on grounding scenarios, so working on de-energized lines.
Yeah.
You might not realize it, but de-energized lines are actually a cause of more fatalities in industry than live working.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Okay. So the issue with working on de-energized lines is that you have many different conductors and objects at different potential, and workers often end up bridging those.
Right.
Live line, you're working on one source at a time of high voltage, and you're much more focused on that risk.
Gotcha.
So you see a lot more incidents during grounding. So that was my initial introduction to live line. And then my boss at that time left Manitoba Hydro and retired. And I got to take over Liveline at the same time as we were going back to work after those accidents that we experienced.
Yep, yep.
So we had about a 10-year break,
mm-hmm.
and then I got to lead us back into that. So I would say also in my life, when I first started working, I had 4 children. I spent the majority of my time focusing on my family.
Mm-hmm.
I started taking extra courses around that time.
Okay.
In 2017.
Yep.
Graduated with a Master's of Science in Electrical Engineering.
Oh, okay.
And right now I'm finishing a PhD. So I feel I have been a lifelong student.
Mm-hmm.
And, doing my education at the same time as working and getting involved in global industry standards. I've had the opportunity to support industry through Manitoba Hydro International. So
right.
Had a very rewarding career. I have a lot of respect for the line workers
mm-hmm.
who put themselves in these situations, working at heights, helicopters, high voltage, and I have a very good relationship with them, and I respect them, and they respect and trust me, I believe, in return. So it's been very rewarding. I'm always learning,
right?
Always new challenges. So.
Yeah. What is a two-shed design for hot sticks? I'm just looking at my notes.
Well, when we went back to work in 2013, when we realized that light contamination of the tool could be a potential cause, it was the most likely cause that we found of the tool flashing over.
Right.
The high voltage testing simulations that we're doing, they're all showing that the sheds can stop these events. So when we went back to in 2013, we implemented these heat shrink sheds that you have to heat up to shrink onto the tool. So you think, I was explaining it in my interview. So think of sometimes when we talk about electricity, it's helpful to think of it as water.
Mm-hmm.
So the flow of water. So imagine a tool, and you have water flowing on its surface, and imagine. If there's nothing in its way, it's just going to flow all the way down and bridge that whole surface. But if we put a shed in the way, it's going to interrupt it and shed the water away. You'd need much more force to get that water to get across. It's the same thing with electricity. So that shed interrupts it. So when we say a two-piece shed, that was a recent innovation that was just driven by the applications we needed. So we want to install these sheds on aerial devices. You can't just, there is nothing we could find that you could, an aerial device is quite a large insulating, I don't know how many inches, but probably a foot across, 12 inches. So, and then also we wanted to put it on ladders. There was an incident in the United States where there was a flashover while a worker was on a ladder. So we said, okay, we want to put these on a ladder. And because of the rungs, you can't just slip something up and down. So that's innovated this design for a two-piece design. So that first technology came out of like the cable industry where they would install in the field. They put those sheds on cables.
Mm-hmm.
So we just took it right from that industry. So it's just constant innovation, finding new ways to do things.
Yeah.
And I hope to see globally, I'd like to see this become a requirement for manufacturers, this is given consideration.
Because
we're innovating, but how about keeping the rest of Canada and our workers safe and globally, right?
Yeah, yeah. So. And are you involved in some of those initiatives to take this work and have it established and embedded in standards nationally, internationally? Is that part,
yes,
of, the,
so I,
part of the work?
So I am a part of IEC right now, which is like the International Electrical Standards, and they have standards for tools, testing, and equipment. So I'm actually the chair of the standard for live working ropes. So I'm working at getting the requirements for these new ropes that can be tested at higher stresses and providing additional safety. So I'm responsible for getting that into an international standard.
Wow.
So it's very challenging. It's like I have to handle concerns from Europe and
international
United States
diplomacy.
And Canada. No,
yeah,
no,
yeah, absolutely.
I had meetings last month, meeting with all these different nations. So the great leadership opportunities.
Right.
But standardization is, it's very challenging, right?
Yeah.
It's one thing to convince your line workers or utility is the best thing, but other countries, it is political and political in a sense. They have their own history and their own beliefs.
Yeah.
And I have to try to convince them of my way of thinking.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jeff, thank you very much. Yeah. Really appreciate you taking the time. And once again, congratulations on being named one of the 2025 faces of the industry. Really appreciate you taking the time to chat.
Thanks for the opportunity to meet with you today.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Tune in for future episodes, including the next episode, which will feature the other three 2025 Faces of the Industry winners. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen, and let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me through our website at electricity.ca, on LinkedIn, and on Instagram as the Brad Bradley. Until the next episode, let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.